Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the Vigilance Press podcast. This is James Dossie. I'll be your host tonight. And tonight I have very special guests, two of our contributors here at Vigilance Press. I have Jason Tondreau, also known as Dr. Comics. Hey, Doc, how you doing?
I'm swell, thank you. And yourself?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. I'm having to stay home and record a podcast instead of going to the movies today, but, you know, I'll live. And also tonight joining me, for the first time in a while, Steve has been really busy, Steve Perrin. Steve, how you doing tonight?
Doing pretty good. Everybody sounds loud and clear. Ready to go.
All right. Sounds good. So tonight we're going to be talking about a couple of the new products and the new marketplace that we've opened up. But before that, I just wanted to kind of do a shout out to... Well, not a shout-out, I guess that's not appropriate, but just a send our thoughts and you know, prayers and whatever is most appropriate to the folks in Colorado tonight. For those of you who haven't heard yet, there was a shooting at the opening of Batman, the Dark Knight Rises, and it's a tragic event. I'm kind of shocked by it, but I hope that... If anybody's listening who knows somebody out there, our sympathies are with you. I didn't know if either of you guys wanted to say anything about that or not before we run along.
Well, I was going to say my shout out briefly to my stepsister Suzanne, mm-hmm. her husband and nephew who all live in Aurora, I know that my nephew Jake loves superheroes and he loves the movies. So don't let these things keep you from doing what you love. I'm glad to hear that everybody is safe and well.
Yep. That's good. Steve, anybody out there that you know?
Nobody in the Denver area at this point in time. I have much sympathy for the people who have been hit by this tragedy, and I hope that recovery will be as quick as possible.
Yeah. I did see a message from Mike Lafferty, if anybody listens to the Banff podcast. I do know that Mike Lafferty is fine. I don't think he went to that particular theater, but he does live in the Colorado area. So if anybody was wondering, I did see a Facebook post from him saying that he's cool. Oh. So.
I forgot Mike Lafferty.
Yeah, yeah. And I have another friend who lives in the Colorado area, but she's actually one of my anime fan friends, who's a producer and director and musician, all around creative person. Jan Fraser has also been posting today, so I know she's okay. But anyway, that was pretty much that kind of cast a pall on the opening for The Dark Knight, which is really unfortunate because apparently it's getting some really good reviews. There's some good buzz coming out from the movie already. Yeah. So I'm hoping to see it next week, but we'll see if I can get the time. Weekends are actually, oddly enough, my busiest time. So anyway, to get from the grim stuff to the fun stuff, we have been busy the past couple of weeks. I have been scrambling to open up a new marketplace, and you can actually find two of our books to order right now on Amazon.com. And the authors of those two books are Steve and Jason.
Yeah, so, what a coincidence. How did that possibly happen?
it's really exciting to have our books in print for the first time. Is this the first time we've had books in print, James?
The very first book we had in print was the special edition of The October Men.
Oh, right, yes.
Which took us about 4 months to kind of suss out all the details and get it ready and done. And I have to say that looking back on it, I really kind of wish I'd started with CreateSpace. CreateSpace is where we're doing our print on demand right now, and CreateSpace is attached to Amazon, so that's why you can order your stuff through Amazon.
Yep.
But CreateSpace made the print on demand so much easier because there's a lot more instant feedback on what you do. With the RPG Now, it basically is very good if you're the guy doing the layout. But if you're not and you have to go back and forth with somebody else, like I do with Ruben, it slows things down tremendously. And they also just you know, it takes about 3 days to get feedback on, you know, when you upload the files to see if it's been accepted by the printer. And then you have to get a physical print to see, you know, and that takes about a week to see if it's actually going to look good. Whereas with the CreateSpace, I was able to get all of that done in like a day. What took me a month and a half to accomplish over on RPG Now with the print stuff has literally taken me about 10 days to get three books done. So people listening, you're going to see a lot more print on demand, but you're also going to see a lot more shorter PDF only stuff too, going forward, because one of the things that was slowing us up was these big products, trying to get them all ready for print on demand and get them ready for the right marketplace. That kind of did slow production and kind of meant that we had put the shorter projects on back burner. But now that we've got that, we've got a short project coming up from Steve, actually. Windsinger and the Woolawa, an American, Native American supervillain, and his summoned, well, I won't call him a minion because he's not exactly the world's best behaved summon. But
no, not really. It tends to blow everything up real good, actually.
Yeah.
What system is this for? Is this for M&M?
It's going to be both for M&M and Icons, but I think it's coming from M&M first.
Oh, good.
Yeah. That's where I actually used it in the game.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And I'm probably going to get and this may be his first time hearing about it, but I'm probably going to get Alex to do the artwork for that. The Devilish Duos are very easy for us to publish and turn around very quickly, so you'll probably start seeing one of those pop up between each one of our big projects, and maybe even two of them pop up, because I do have actually about a half dozen of the Devilish Duos manuscripts already from various authors, including Jack Norris and Steve Perrin. So, and I can probably, you know, leverage Jason into doing one or two for us, too.
Oh, you know what I always wanted to do, if we get the chance, is the two, is to do some write-ups for, based on the two members of the Forgotten Five that died in the 80s.
I think we can put that together. That would actually make for a good tandem release with the Forgotten Five.
Yeah, so I wasn't sure whether we would want to do the actual write-ups for them, which is the Commissar, who's my Red Menace villain, and Solar Khan, Lord of the East, who is my Yellow Peril villain. Okay. And I wasn't sure whether we should do the actual write-ups for the guys before they died / vanished, or if we should do, like, modern characters who have adopted their names, like legacy villains.
Well, you know, I hate to choose, so why don't we do both?
Yeah, we could. We could totally do both.
Sure.
Especially if you have one template, and then you just sort of maybe swap out a couple of things here and there to represent either the modern version or the 80s version.
Yeah, that should be pretty fun.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, like, Windsinger and Woolawa are originally intended for to be more World War II villains.
Oh, really?
But the Woolawa being an air elemental and Windsinger's powers coming from a magical American Native American item.
Oh yeah.
There can be modern day versions of them pop up very easily.
Right. Yeah.
And I believe our intent is to actually put a sidebar in that on how you adapt these World War II villains as modern day villains, or even somewhere in between.
Yep, I'll have to double check the manuscript to see if we've got that in there. If we don't, I'll have you.
I haven't done it yet.
Oh, okay.
We talked about it, but I haven't done it yet.
Well, we'll have to get you to do that before I publish it, then. Now that you've put it out in the air, it's in the book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was intending, you know. The manuscript I sent you was not complete, absolutely. It was, waiting for some official response and so forth. So.
Okay, good deal. Yeah, we're probably going to shoot for...
There you go.
I don't know how much...
The inner workings of Vigilant Press.
Yeah, right. Yeah, actually, a lot of the stuff that has been backburnered is going to start being, you know, fast tracked just because the ease of what we're doing, you know, starting to fill in. The gears are starting to turn, you know. And also, and a big part of that is, you know, the different people who have come on board in the past 6 months. Alex being like a big piece of that puzzle. Alex Williamson, the artist. If you haven't seen his artwork, there's a good chunk of it posted up on the Vigilantist Press website. Excuse me. There's, you know, if you go and check the gallery, the Beacon City Challengers, that's all his work. He did the art, the line art for the Six Gun product, which is under the Due Vigilance line.
And that's great stuff, by the way.
Oh man, it's fantastic. I can't wait to show the rest of it, because he just gave me a whole bunch more that Yad won't be coloring. Yad's going to be doing the main six villains, and then I'm going to be coloring the other characters. I'm going to be doing kind of a comic book style, the kind of solid color comic book style that's a little more subtle and kind of not as standout as what Yad does. But it's, you know, hopefully all those characters will stand out. But it's just like he puts so much energy and personality into these concepts that he does, these character illustrations. It's just so much fun to turn over stuff and then watch it. And he's really good at working from like my sketches as well. He's really good at bringing the character, you know, if I give him a specific character, bam, it's there. If I ask for something where I just give him a text description, bam, he's got that too. So I've very rarely met an artist who's able to kind of work with both kinds of assets and just kind of come up with a character who's really dead on to what you want. And he still brings more to it than you expect. So he's got that energy, kind of like Dan Houser does, that real fast paced energy that you want from a collaborative artist. Speaking of collaborative artists, let's talk a little bit about the Homefront villains. We'll start with that. Because unfortunately John Gibbons wasn't, he lives on the other side of the world. And trying to get him on the podcast would mean we'd be all up at, I think, like 3 a.m. or something. But, John Gibbons did all of our interior artwork for that book. And,
beautiful stuff.
Oh yeah. Fantastic. I love the artwork. I love the concepts that he came up with, the, character art. A lot of people are going to wonder why or if, and I did write a short note from the publisher at the beginning of the book, but there is a specific reason why the artwork looks the way it does, and it wasn't done. There are no standees in the back like I usually do, and the main reason for that, quite simply, is the art was ordered before I took over Vigilantist Press, and so the requirements were different back then. So
I see. Yeah.
So John basically did a great job fulfilling, you know, the art as it was ordered, but, you know, I didn't want to turn around and then pay for a whole new set of artwork just because I wanted to do the standees. So we basically went with kind of the older Vigilant style of layout and requirements. So you're going to get a different set of, you know, kind of stat block illustrations and stat block layout than you will in the field guide book. But it's still, the content is all there. The artwork is great. The cover is by Denise Jones, and it's gorgeous. Oh man, I love that piece.
Oh yeah, and it's a great homage cover too, because it's kind of taken from All Star Comics number 41, I believe it is.
Was it? Because I totally pulled that out of my head. I was just flipping randomly through different kind of
similar, certainly not the same in any way, shape, or form, but similar, with the idea of the villains carving up the United States, basically, from either the first or second Injustice Society story and the old Justice Society of America stories.
You know, now that you mention it, that may have probably been in my head in the back of my head, inspiring me. But I didn't consciously think about it. But when Denise and I were sitting down talking about the cover, she basically sent, you know, I described her one thing, and she sent me back a sketch, and I said, no, here. And I basically sent her back a real quick doodle of, you know, a big rough semicircle occupying the bottom of the screen, and then like stick figures for the characters. And she said, oh, okay, I got it. No problem. And then I got so busy between the time that I turned over that and every step, you know, she's basically saying, okay, I'm ready to go to the next step. And I'm like, go ahead. I trust you. And I never had a chance because every time she would communicate with me, I was either out running errands or something. I never really had a chance to kind of eyeball it the rest of the time. So when she turned it over, I looked at it. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. It was like a revelation because I hadn't actually gotten to see the intermediary stages on this particular product. But I love the detail on the globe, the detail on the characters. She took the character designs that that John Gibbonson created and just absolutely, you know, brought them to life. I love.
Oh, yeah.
I love the shark boss, the gangster character. I love him. He's so much fun.
And boss shark, yes.
Yep. So tell us a little bit about some of your favorite characters from the book there. Steve?
Okay, good. well, let's see. Actually, the lead Nazi villain, Baron Barbarossa, I thought worked out pretty well. I've used him two or three times in my World War II campaign that I'm running right now, and they finally caught him, but I'm sure I can get him out fairly soon. I generally find, though, that it is really a good idea for him to have minions around that he can drain for power, because getting it from heroes is always so much of a pain, particularly in a game with things like hero points from Mutants and Masterminds or determination points where you can essentially negate something that's already happened.
Yeah.
So definitely anytime you see Baron Barbarossa, there should be two or three minions sort of crawling around on the ground with no strength or anything else because you sucked it out of them so that he'll be at full power when he's fighting you. The Cretaceans, the ancient dinosaur race from the mists of time, are actually something I've been using since about 97. That was 87. And then 87. Yeah, 87. For a campaign I did ages ago, and I basically figure that every superhero world I run a campaign in has diverged after the time of the Cretaceans. So they're there no matter what.
Okay.
Oh, nice.
So I always have the Cretaceans in the background ready to pop up and do unfortunate things to heroes and strange scientists and hard rock miners and things like that. So they are a long-term favorite of mine. Finally got them published, so to speak.
Yeah. I have to say my favorite so far is heavily influenced by the art, but I really like the gimmick villain, the Mistress of the Night.
John went out of his way to make that lady really, really neat, and Denise did excellent job of emulating that. In point of fact, when I submitted the manuscript, that was a male. It took John, obviously an artist with a visual appreciation, to say, don't you need at least one female in this group? And I went, oh, yeah, well, aside from the Cretaceans, they're all female. But God knows what A-bomb is. But, and I went, oh, yeah, right. That one will probably be the best female character. And I just used her, actually, in some Masterminds version of her in a game very recently with my World War II group. And they seem to appreciate having her around, too. And she's still out there. She got away, too. Anyway.
You know, so, I have to put in a request.
Yeah.
Steve,
yeah.
Do you remember Aaron Alston's book, Strike Force?
Sure do.
You know, and everybody that's played Champions knows that that was probably the best Champions supplement they ever put out, because Aaron had this campaign, you know, and he'd run this campaign and all these characters, and they all interacted with each other, and they were beautifully illustrated, and he put in a bunch of the PCs, but also all of their enemies, and he showed how the campaign evolved and all their – and, you know, Steve, you stand out from a lot of other game writers in that you actually, you know, play these characters like week by week by week in a campaign. A lot of us, you know, we don't, a lot of – and I'm speaking somewhat from experience. I still get to play once in a while, but not as much as I would like. So many of us, we don't have the time to run the game as much as we wish we did. And you do. Uh-huh. And we should – you should do, you know, do a campaign book. You know, get – I would love to see one day – all of, you know, your campaign and your multiverse, you know, you've talked about all these different worlds and they all sort of connect. I would love to see that book one day. And, you know, God knows if we could put it out, if James would be able to do it. But, boy, that sure would be great to read.
Well, the only problem with that
there
is,
always is
but it's a fairly major one, is that I am a, shall we say, very thorough researcher.
Yeah.
As in the Tom Lear, pleased to be calling it research, not not stealing.
Okay.
So, for instance, Aaron Alston's original campaign, I have his original write-up. Not the one, as well as the one that got published by Hero. But, you know, his original campaign is full of references to Marvel and DC and so forth,
that's
comic
right.
books.
That's right, yes.
And so is my multiverse. So a lot of the basic building blocks of my universe are actually the comics.
So you steal like an artist is the modern way to say that.
Plagiarize, that's the term. Yes, for Tom Lear's old song, plagiarize. Only pleased to be calling it research. And I love the comics, you know, I read them, not as much as I used to because I ran out of money to read them, but I still pick up occasional graphic novels and so forth. So I have very elaborate schemes and so forth and histories, which are actually tied up with comic book characters.
Yeah.
So it would be a major creative effort to get all of that shifted over to something that Visual Express could publish without being sued.
right.
well, I'll tell you what. That's one of the things that kind of made my career as a GM a little bit fun was I was an unabashed thief too.
Yeah.
I still remember when I was about. I think I was 16 or 17. I was running a superhero game. I think we were using Champions. But I had the Swamp Thing up here, and it was the Alan Moore-style Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
So it was sort of, you know, in an episode. And I was trying to talk the way he speaks in the comics, and I started getting lightheaded. The heavy breathing and the breathing on the inhale, and it was just so I'm like, okay, this character can only show up once in a whole bloom. But it was kind of interesting because one of the things I noticed about my players is that very few of them read the same comic books that I did or read comic books at all. But all of them enjoyed playing the superhero campaign, so they wouldn't know the difference between a Swamp Thing that I'd stolen from DC Heroes and one of my homebrew characters. They didn't know the difference, so it was all one world to them.
It was interesting, actually, at a convention around here many years ago, I ran the last scenario in that Strike Force book, the multiversal scenario.
Yep.
Except that I used, rather than the Strike Force characters, I was using DC characters and Marvel characters and Archie superheroes.
Oh, that's cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, the shield and like that, not the because I already had write-ups from another game I'd done of all the Archie shield fly and so forth characters. And it was interesting because our heroes lost the initial fight, found themselves in the secret lair of the villains. I had people like Darkseid and so forth, including Black Paladin and Mechamon, right? I had like Darkseid, I had Ultron, I had the Brain Emperor, who is one of the archivillains, and the Eraser, who's one of his big minions, and so forth. And the guys who are playing the game are sitting up there going, oh, yeah, I know that one. That's from Archie Comics. Yeah, right, and that's Darkseid and things like that. And they didn't recognize Black Paladin and Ultron at all.
Right.
It was a Champions game, but they had no idea who the Champions Universe characters were.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's kind of, that's a little sad.
to be fair, though, I think a great many champions or superhero GMs do this. You know, especially when we're creating our first campaign, we just pillage from our favorite comics shamelessly.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a, you're right. It's a shame because then we can't publish that world without doing a lot of rewriting. But you know,
I do have one world. Which, in fact, is the one that the Creative Creations originally came from.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much original. It was all the serial numbers of various characters had already been filed off when I did it. It's set in the late 40s, early 50s. It's sort of between the gold and the silver age.
Yeah.
And but it's, you know, international, and it's got all sorts of stuff because it was a United Nations-based superhero force.
Right.
Called Vanguard. Maybe we'll talk about that sometime.
Okay.
Because that one is, aside from all being in champion stats, it's you know, kind of all set and ready to go.
Yep. Yeah, one of the things I remember that got me into hacking systems, I'm staring at it on the shelf over here. I have these old Adventurers Club magazines from the Hero System.
Yeah,
and
sure.
There was an issue where they showed you how to convert characters from the DC Heroes role-playing game to the champions. And I
use that all the time.
Yeah.
Yep.
I've got it sitting on my shelf right now, and it's dog-eared because I've used that millions of times.
And that kind of got me into hacking systems after reading that and the idea of, like, well, you know, you know, when you can draw parallels between these two things, how do you do it in other ways? And that kind of ballooned. But I loved the Champions universe just because it was so different from any comic book universe at the time.
Yeah.
It had little homages and little pieces of the comic book kind of aesthetic, but it also had a really heavy dose of the gamer mentality that was actually missing from the comics at the time, because the comics, this was back in the late 70s, early 80s, and the comics had kind of, we're still clinging to this 70s aesthetic, and the one of the things that the gamer, you know, thinks about things in kind of problem solving real world terms, and in a way that doesn't necessarily make it into a comic book script, at least not that back then. Nowadays we have much more gritty kind of realism. But you had crazy characters in there that were just as goofy as something that you had from a comic book like Fox Bat with his ping pong ball gun.
Yeah.
Which did you read the description? Have you read the description of where Fox Bat came from?
I don't remember. I may have. It's been
a while. This is classic. Go ahead, Steve. I know this story.
Basically, Mark Williams drew the cover of Enemies 2 and drew Fox Bat on there, and that was the first time he had ever appeared anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And Bruce Harlick suddenly had to create a Fox Bat to go with that picture.
Yeah, because Bruce asked, well, what is that on his chest? And Mark said, it's a fox. Or maybe it's a bat. And that's how he got his name, Fox Bat.
Right.
Fantastic. So one of the things that, because again, this was one of those projects that came in before I'd taken over, and you'd pretty much turned over the manuscript for Homefront villains. How, and, but you say you did get some feedback from John before you, you know, before obviously it was finished. How much back and forth did you guys do with the looks of the various, excuse me, the various characters, or is it pretty much just from your pen to John's brain?
pretty much my pen to John's brain. Yeah, the whole Midnight Mistress thing was about all, was the only major change of any kind that happened. John was very good at just going, oh, yeah, American Indian type, got this, sure, here you go. And I'd look at it and say, yeah, that's it, moving on. I think we had a little discussion about exactly what Baron Barbarossa looked like, but not much. And that was about it. Everything else, it was John took my description and said, yep, okay, there you go.
All right, cool. Now, I guess, let's see. I'm just checking my time here. We've got about half an hour we've eaten up. Let's start talking about Jason's project a little bit.
Oh, sure.
So you're not feeling too left out.
I'm fine. I'm cool.
Jason, this is the last of the field guides for superheroes.
Huzzah!
Did that feel like a relief, or was that like, man, I'm sorry to end this?
Well, as I wrote a little bit on the developer's guide, you know, I never thought we'd actually be able to publish the thing because it's so big. I mean, it doesn't seem like it compared to, you know, a lot of other role-playing game products. I mean, you get a 250-page rule book or something, and, you know, that's really hefty. But for a small press like us, especially when we started this project, which was when Chuck was still running things and everything we did was PDF and it all had to be small and cheap, you know, because that was our model. It was like we just didn't have the money to invest in large projects. And so the idea that we could do a product which is not only 40 different archetypes, but all with sample characters and all with extensive backgrounds, because I write, you know, pages. And the ultimate word count was pretty high, and 40 characters means 40 pieces of art. And then we thought, well, it's not enough art, so now we need another set of illustrations, so that now we've got 80 pieces of art. And it just becomes really intimidating for a small press like us.
Right.
So yeah, it's really great to see it concluded. I mean, so many projects start and never finish. And that's okay with some books because they're not necessarily dependent on each other. You know, a lot of archetype mm-hmm. products come out and they've got three or four or six or two different archetypes in there, and you just buy them like popcorn. You know, they're not related to each other. But the field guide is alphabetical order, man.
Yeah. I was about to say it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to stop off at M. You know.
Yeah. Or, exactly. So it's
like
really
something missing.
Yeah, yeah, half the alphabet. So it's really great to get to the end.
Can I just put in here something I did the last time we were talking about one of my projects, that this field guide was my inspiration for how I organized both Homefront Heroes and Homefront Villains.
Which is deeply flat.
Archetype, sample, was actually inspired by Jason's work.
Well, it's deeply flattering. I'm going to take that with me when we're done today. The whole history of the product is up on the website now, so I won't bother to repeat it all. But yes, it's really great to see it finally resolve. And I have to say that, okay, so this is a little known story about me. My first published comic work was published by Robert Kirkman. Back before he was famous.
Okay.
If you know Robert Kirkman, now he's the Walking Dead guy. But 10 years ago...
I think of him as the Invincible guy, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and this is before any of that, before he got his big break writing, I think, Jubilee for Marvel. But he owned a little comics company of his own called Funkotron. And he took a risk on a bunch of writers and artists who we decided to do an anthology book. And I hooked up with this gang on the floor of the Chicago Comic Con, where I was walking around handing out portfolios and trying to find work. And these guys got one of my portfolios, and they called me back, and they said, yeah, we've got an empty spot for a writer. Why don't you join us? Here's your artist. Go to town. So I wrote this four-part, 32-page story called Nautilus, which was essentially the great-great-grandson of Captain Nemo. It was Iron Man meets Aquaman.
Okay.
So he had like a, you know, an underwater adventure suit sort of thing. Anyway, so I wrote this story, and Robert started to publish us, and we got three issues into it, and it was just – he was losing too much money on it. It cost too much money to publish. And so the final volume of Nautilus never came out. It was three issues out of four forever, right? And to be fair, now I have to – speaking honestly about this, it's not a very good comic. I learned a lot about comics writing, and I had some challenges with my artist, and who he was very talented, but you know, he didn't draw the story I wrote. So there's challenges there. So it's really nice to sort of feel like, well, I had this other thing that was also four parts. It was also a big risk. And this time we followed through. So that's very cool. And I'm very, very grateful to everybody at Vigilance, including Dan and James and Chuck, and our layout guy who helped with the fourth volume.
Yeah, Ruben,
who took all that extra time to do to lay out the fourth volume. I don't know if we'll get a chance to ever go back and make the first three look the same, but it's really great.
It's one of those things where I'm much more likely to go back, I think, and take those and re-edit them for publication to make them available as print on demand. If I do that, I will update the files for the people who've already bought it so they can just re-download it again from RPG Now.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
You know, I wouldn't resell it, but I would probably make it available as a print-on-demand so you can have all four books kind of sitting on the shelf next to each other. That would probably be a goal. We'll probably look into doing that perhaps early next year. I don't want to pledge too much to it just now, but it's definitely something that I would like to do, and we might even talk to Dan about sprucing up and adding some additional artwork. So that would be kind of fun, I think, because I think you know, he's an artist like myself who's always, you know, kind of looking back on stuff and going, wow, I was proud of that then. Now I wish I could do more. You know, every artist is like that. I'm not speaking in terms of a value judgment on my part. I'm just saying, you know, he's said to me several times that he would, you know, like to go back and kind of have a second chance at certain things.
Well, Steve will back me up on this one. I mean, the writers did the exact same thing.
But, you know. That's something that I think we could definitely look into, and if we did that, you know, I'm not sure how much you would want to update the text at all, but that would, you know, there'd be an opportunity to do that if we wanted to.
Well, one of the things it's always been a little challenging with the World of Wonder is exactly kind of, I think it gets back to what you were talking about, which you were describing as a gamer mentality in Champions, but I think what you were trying to get at there was just a kind of sense that let's approach this setting in a way that's maybe a little bit more realistic and isn't required to always stay the same. And that's what I mean by realistic. I don't necessarily mean, you know, what if the heroes really existed, because Champions isn't like that at all. But rather
maybe progressive.
It's a living world. It's not locked into an essentially static status quo for the last 50 years. And so World of Wonder was always very topical. I wrote it in the years just right after 9/11, and so it was very much informed by the sort of Bush presidency and our concerns with Homeland Security and all that business. And as the years have gone by, I've kind of looked at some of that stuff and seen it as feeling most dated. If I had a chance to go back and update some of that stuff, it's not necessarily because my writing appalls me. Sometimes it does, but but rather because it has references to things about characters getting old. And the classic example of this is actually in the very first book, I think, which is Victor E. Victor's whole point is that he's like the latest model. He's the fifth model of this ultimate superhero. Mm-hmm. And nobody in the world knows that he's actually an android. And he's on the, you know, the fifth version. Well, his whole character is built on this idea that he's running out of time. Everybody around him is getting more and more powerful and more dangerous, and he is never changing. And so the day when he gets beat and gets remade into Victor F is inevitable. Right. And books like – and A Chance to Go Back and Revisit These Texts invites me to go in and make that guy, to replace Victor E with Victor F. And then the guys who have the original version of Victor would have something that the new people that buy the Victor F version don't have, and vice versa. So what would the new Victor be like, and how would the old Victor have gotten killed or destroyed, and what new power set does Victor F have that makes him able to survive what Victor E didn't, and so on. So that would be kind of cool to do. I would like to keep the world alive in that sense.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that's always seduced me about gaming, and I think you know, maybe me more so than some of my other players, but at least current players. But one of the things I loved about a superhero game setting is that when you created a sense of continuity, that it would actually be important forever, because, you know, I mean, I look back on games I played in high school and I can trace some of the ideas that I still have in my games back all the way back there. And you know, it's like, you know, maybe some of these characters have gone through some reboots and retcons and changes, but, you know, when you're playing a campaign, you have this opportunity to create a timeline that makes sense to you as a player. And you know, often when you're reading as a comic book, you know, reading a comic or, you know, you're a passive kind of participant, you don't have that opportunity to really, you know, so, you know, sometimes you'll just look at something and go, that doesn't make sense. That's ridiculous. You know, no character would do that. Have you guys ever, what was the longest running campaign you guys ever kind of ran in a game? Steven, let's start with you.
Yeah, and we may end with you too, because you're going to trump me. Yeah.
Well, the longest running campaign I've ever run with a pretty much a direct continuity and the same character showing up at the beginning and the end and in between was probably the same one I was talking about before. I started it in 1987, and it began in 1947 when the United Nations began. And it ran very continuously, like two or three times a week sometimes, for 3 or 4 years. And then we'd come back to it for arcs, two or three month arcs from then on. And then I moved to Southern California, because this is all up in the Bay Area. I moved to Southern California, got some other things going, and then one of my other co-GMs, because there were several of us playing, running it, started running it at DunderCon every year. And then he went up and died in 2000. When was that? Four? Can't remember now. No, a little later than that, six maybe. Anyway, he died, so I took over doing that. So every year, that there's still been another Vanguard game taking up 1 year after the previous Vanguard game to the present time.
Wow.
So it's been from 87 to now.
Yeah, you win.
Years.
I should have started with me.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, you know, once I set down roots in a place, I hate leaving. I've been living in the same place here for 17 years now. Which, given that we're renting, is not bad. I'll come back to stuff and use old stuff and revamp it and things like that. So my stuff continues. Like I said, I go back to the Cretaceans. I've now got them in about four different game systems.
Yeah.
So does that, how many systems has that particular campaign survived? I mean, you're obviously talking about the same continuity.
Well, in point of fact, one of the reasons why it happens that way is that it's about the only time we get together to play Champions. That's been a Champion system game from the beginning to now, as far as the Vanguard games are concerned.
Yeah, gotcha.
Now, okay. I've done other games. I took my original D&D campaign, turned it into a pseudo D&D RuneQuest campaign, like 20 years later.
Yeah.
Not 20 actual years, 20 years as far as the world was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And then I jumped to I was using the Star Wars D6 system, which I called Fantasy D6, for the for that campaign 50 years later, in which some people were playing sons and daughters of people they'd played in my previous campaign, and others were doing brand new characters, of course, because they were brand new to the world. So I've done that one in D&D, RuneQuest, and D6, and then I ended up doing it in Fantasy Hero, and that was the same campaign. I went from the D6, which people were having problems with, to Fantasy Hero, which everybody was familiar with.
Yeah.
So that one has changed. And of course, as I say, I've done the same character in several different game systems simply because I'm doing kind of the same world, but different. I did a campaign here in Southern California that started out being Sentinels of Justice. What was it? Same people do Big Eyes, Small Mouth.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It died when the company died, basically. But we decided we were discussing with it before that, so I switched that over to Champions, and recently did a couple of pre-done, published by Ronan, Green Ronan, scenarios of the same characters doing M&M. So,
okay.
So anyway, I've done that a lot.
So, Jason.
Yeah.
Can you come close to that?
Oh, no way.
I got nothing.
No way. I tend to, I should note that my wife would love it if I did that. Because she's always saying, well, why don't we go back and run that campaign that you were running before you stopped running it? You know, because that was great. We loved that game. But I tend to cycle. I get new ideas. Games stop for one reason or another. Players leave or we move or I have to put everything on hold so I can write my dissertation or whatever. And
small stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, and when it comes time to start a new campaign up, everybody says, well, why don't we just pick up the old campaign? And I'm like, oh, I never look back, darling, I have so many games that I want to run that I tend to look forward. And especially I tend to, if I'll pick games that maybe the system goes out of publication.
Yeah.
I like experimenting with new systems, and I sometimes have a hard time with games that are no longer in print. I feel like it's no longer being supported. And I know that this is completely irrational, because if the game works perfectly fine, why should I stop playing it? But for some reason, I do. But my longest... Go ahead.
I just came out of a game we're playing Fusion.
Oh, yeah. Wow, yeah. Yeah. Well, my longest campaigns, I'm trying to think back. I ran a lot of Fantasy Hero back when I was writing for Hero Games, and this is before Steve Long and that whole gang came in and bought the company. So back when it was still the original crew, I was creating their fantasy setting. I had been contracted to create this setting, and so I ran tons of Fantasy Hero for years in what we call the Broken Kingdom setting. It was published before ebooks were cool. It was an ebook before ebooks were cool, because we didn't have the money to publish it in hard copy, so we printed it on disc. This is, before the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, So I ran a lot of Fantasy Hero, and we ran that campaign over many years. This is in my post-college days. Since then, I ran a three-year D&D 4th edition campaign, which was very successful. We met most every week, had a really great time. We only stopped that campaign. Anybody who's out there listening and knows 4th edition will know exactly what I'm talking about. The game starts to be unsupported once you hit the epic levels. Once you hit to about level 21, 22, you find out that no books apply to you anymore. All the books are for heroic and paragon tier, and there's almost no adventures for epic tier. And there's a reason why, and that's because by the time you hit epic tier, it's become a math game. The numbers are so high. Yeah. You spend so much time managing all of your character choices and your powers and adding up the numbers, and it starts to become a game that only engineers love. So we played to about level 23, and then we wrapped it up and had a big epic finale, and everyone seems to have been pretty happy with it. But now just to give you an example, so I said, okay, well, that's all right, because that game is over, but now I'm going to run a game I've always wanted to run for years and years, and that's Ars Magica, which is a wonderful game, and it appeals to history nerds like me. And so I said, okay, let's run Ars Magica. So we all got together and we spent months on characters and the setting creation and everything, and everybody figured out what we were going to do. And then as soon as we get ready to meet, I get a job in Georgia. Right? So this is exactly what happens. And Ars Magica is a game that takes 5 years to play. I mean, because it's all about the setting moving forward about 1 year every game session. And your characters live for 100 years, so to make it all the way to the end of an Ars Magica campaign is a serious long-haul goal. So naturally, as soon as I start a game, I have to shut it down and move across the country. I should have done this 3 years ago. You know, I should have started this game 3 years ago, and then I would have got a job. Yeah. But anyway, so I'm going to move now and move across the country, and we'll see what kind of players I can find. And this also determines a lot extent of what game I run. You know, the reason why we ran that D&D game wasn't because I would have chosen to run 4E. I mean, I'm a big Mutants and Masterminds fan. I love that genre and the game, and I was all set to run that. But the players wanted to play D&D, so you got to go where the players are.
Yep.
You know Sean Fannin?
Say that again?
Yeah.
Oh, Sean Fannin, yeah.
Yeah. Check with him about people who play in Georgia.
Or you could check with me. Actually, Sean Fannin moved to Alabama, but he was in Atlanta for a long time.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sean and I were actually going to collaborate on Broken Kingdoms. This is back when Fantasy Hero was publishing, because Sean had his own fully developed fantasy setting, and we were talking with the editors at Hero on how to incorporate these two settings into one world, and because he wanted to publish his stuff. Of course, you know, he went on to do completely other things, but Sean's a really good guy.
I have to get Sean back on the podcast again. We had a lot of fun last time he was on.
Yeah.
And it was a matter of me going, oh, wow, I didn't realize you worked on that. Oh, wow, I didn't realize you worked on that. It's like, oh, wow, I have that book right next to me. my longest campaign probably was a Champions campaign that ran from – I want to say, Mark Archila can correct me on this. He's one of my old players from that time period.
Yeah.
But and he's a Facebook fan, so he'll probably tell me I got the year wrong. But
Thank God for Facebook, right?
Yeah. But he basically was in this group, and we started, I think, in 87, I want to say 86 or 87, and then ran until I was a good chunk of the way through college, and probably after my first degree. So that was about 6 to 8 years, somewhere in there. That was the longest running campaign I've ever had. And I think the secret to me for a campaign, for sticking with the same campaign, is running more than one time a week.
Oh, really?
Having two games a week just keeps me in the headspace.
I have to play every week or I get really bored. Because I tend to do a lot of pre-planning. Mm-hmm. So if I'm running, if I'm running a campaign and I think up an adventure or something, I've got to play that adventure out next week, because if it sits around on my desk for a month before we finish it, I am so bored by the end of it that I'm about to cry.
Yeah.
So I have to play every week just to get these things rolling.
Yeah, that's my problem, because I'm constantly engineering. Everybody else kind of leaves the game, goes to their day-to-day lives, and comes back and starts to go, okay, where were we a week later?
Right.
And me, I've been in the headspace of that game the entire week. I can't leave it behind.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's
try learning about three at a time.
That might help. That might help. I could. I actually used to do that.
I'm so jealous.
I would run like two or three times a week, and I would usually have one day of the week be the Supers game, one be our long running fantasy game, and then if we had another time where people could get together, we'd like play Magic the Gathering or something. You know, we'd do different things. But that was back when nobody had jobs. We were all just students, so we could do whatever we wanted to with our free time. But nowadays everybody's working, so trying to get people together for more than one day a week is kind of hard. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I am bringing in one guest, and I am going to say goodnight to Steve. Steve, thank you again for joining us, and for everyone listening, Steve's recent book, The Homefront Villains, is part of our Amazing Stories of World War II, and that is available now. You can get all the links on vigilancepress.com. You can go to our shopping links page. You can find it on RPG Now. You can find it on Amazon.com, Amazon.Europe. You can find it on CreateSpace. The CreateSpace link is on our website. If you have any trouble finding it, shoot me an email, james@jamesdossie.com. But really proud of that book. Really glad to finally have it out there. And I can't wait till you get your copy, Steve.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to having it in my honest-to-gosh hands. It'll be great.
Yep. All right, cool.
So, really good talking to everybody. I've got to take off now, but hang in there.
All right, thank you, Steve. Stay vigilant.
Talk to you, Eric.
All right,
okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Steve is signing off, and we are adding a new member to the group. Dan Hauser, how are you doing?
Hey, guys, doing good.
Hey, just to prove that I have not alienated Dan from the podcast.
Oh, man, no. Work has alienated me from all forms of outside communication.
It's like every time I ask you to join, you're like, yeah, no problem. And then at the last minute, can't be there. I'm like, come on.
Yeah, I've got if I have a couple days notice, I can definitely do it. But if I don't, I can't. Today worked out just fine. I actually just got back from The Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, okay.
Don't spoil anything.
Don't spoil anything.
I'll just say that I am probably the biggest Batman fan I know, and it's the best Batman movie I've ever seen.
Okay.
All right. Well, cool. You're the only person in our podcast who's actually seen it.
Yeah.
But I'll probably end up going to see it next week sometime. I don't think I'll have a chance before then. But we were talking about The Field Guide to Superheroes, Volume 4. And I was meant, Jason gave us a wonderful history of the Field Guide series, which is up on our – it's a blog post on vigilancepress.com. You can look for it there. He mentioned you, Dan, and I think you actually read that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came on to the Field Guide project and how that relationship developed over the four volumes.
Well, at the time, Chuck Rice was running things at Vigilance, and Mike Lafferty was handling the day-to-day for artists and some of the writers. Mike introduced me to Jason and said, hey, I've got this manuscript that Jason wrote. Look at it and see if you have any ideas for a cover. That was our initial conversation. I said, okay, sure. I'm like, why isn't there going to be art in there? And he was like, well, it's kind of a business decision that Chuck's making on this one. He wants to get this book out there, but he can't afford to do full color art and all this other stuff. And so I just said, you know what, I'll do it on spec. I'll just get it done, and when it makes money, I'll make money. And so I did the artwork that way. And then
That was the only way it would ever have gotten done.
Right. Well,
the only way we ever could have gotten interior art is if someone like you had agreed to do it as a percentage.
Yeah, and I just said, sure, I'll do it. First of all, the quality of the writing and the caliber of the actual product made me go, this thing needs art, and I wanna have copies of this and have it look good.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you. That's kind of you to say.
And it's the truth. I just seriously said, I got to work with this guy. So, and I've made a lot of decisions that way. And most of the products that I've done that with, if not all, bam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always, all good. So,
yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting how many times, I mean, I won't say that's the best business decision in the world to just do stuff for free. But I will say that a lot of the times, a lot of those creative endeavors, if everybody on board is really behind it and pushes, you know, you can sometimes have some rewarding experiences from that. I mean, even if it doesn't make a lot of money, it's usually the collaboration itself is often its own reward. But
that makes money.
Case,
you cut me a check every month.
Yep.
it's never a giant check, but it's always something.
Yep. No, it was actually, and of course, now that the field guide Volume 4 is out, people have 4 books and they can pick up the whole thing. One of the things that people were asking me about actually on Facebook and other places were, are you going to do a compilation? And I you know, and as a publisher, you know, I hate to answer that question the wrong way, because in the publisher's ears, what he often hears is not, are you going to make a product that I really, really want to buy? The question is, can I not buy this one and just wait?
Right. Yeah, it's the issue, the monthly comics versus the graphic novel, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's like, no, go ahead, buy this one.
Yeah. And I'll say this for the record, okay? If there was to be a compilation, what I'd like to do is I'd like to do the art for it again, but redo all of it.
See, I was just telling them you'd say that. So now people know I wasn't making that up.
Here's what's great about it is, like, you look at the first one and you look at the last one. Looking at the art going from the first one to the last one, it's improved. And I'm so much better than I was on that fourth book. So it's like I would prefer that the whole thing looks like one style rather than when I'm dibbling and dabbling in other stuff before I got down all the anatomy stuff that I know now. You know, and buckling down like 2-3 years at Gen Con with James and actually going, okay, that's how things work. Because it's much easier to learn anatomy. Kids, if you're trying to learn how to draw, find somebody who already knows how to draw and ink their stuff. They hate doing it, and you'll learn a lot more that way.
Yeah, that's smart, yeah.
One of the things that, you know, we were talking about, and this ties into what you're saying, is that, you know, as proud as we are of the products, you know, artists and authors alike always look back at something and go, you know, if I just had a little more time, or if I just had another pass at something, or I just had this great idea that would have been so much better than what I did. You know, you're always looking back on stuff and going, if I just could do that again. One of the things that I would want to do, and I think Jason would want to do, is not compile the books, but actually just go back through the books and get them ready for print. Because the first 3 books are not print ready. They don't have the
that's right.
They don't meet the color gap requirements and things like that. So it would probably require us to do new artwork anyway, and get higher resolution artwork and a bunch of other, you know, and make sure that the colors were printable. And that's, you know, means basically hiring Dan all over again. This time probably not for spec. I don't know.
Hey, that'd be great.
But the idea would be anyone who had already owned the books would just get to update the file, and they wouldn't have to buy it again. But it would become available for print on demand. So the process there is possible, and I will probably do that. Over time, like, I'm looking at probably next year for Volume 1 if we do that. But it's definitely a project that I think would be fun to do. And,
but it makes sense, you know, to we got a bunch of other stuff to do.
Yeah. We want to put out new stuff.
You have so many things in the pipe, it's silly.
Yeah. I mean, right now I'm looking at about over a dozen finished manuscripts that we're trying to get published.
Yeah.
And each one, like, more ambitious than the last. Yeah. You know, I've got everything from Mutant Future, the Pacific Northwest. We've got that manuscript in. Nathan's editing it now. And we've got, we'll be ordering art for that probably after I get back from Gen Con. I'll probably ring up John Gibbons and see what his production slate looks like. You know, what his dance card looks like.
Yeah.
And because I really want him to do the map again. I really liked the map that we got last time. And this time we're going to be using no clip art, but all new art. So I'm assuming that Alex will want to draw some mutants for us and giant frogs and things. So yeah, you guys are going to love the Pacific Northwest. It's got some crazy stuff in it. But we've also been talking about, you know, as far as ambitious goes, we've also been talking about some other projects. And I can't say anything specifically right now, but
they're really, really cool.
Yeah. I mean, everything, you know, of course, Arthur Lives, which we keep pushing back, but I keep showing people artwork saying, yes, look, it's real, it's just not ready. And, you know, that's something that Jason and I kind of keep deciding that, you know, we want to make it, but, you know, it's like the timing has to work out for our benefit, you know, for everybody's benefit, so that we're not publishing it 1 year and then revising it the next year or something. You know, we want to put out the definitive book.
Yeah. And fortunately, this is something which I can work on in the meantime. I mean, if for example, if we're waiting for the right system or the right window to put out the first book, the sort of season one book, nothing prevents me from starting to outline and draft season two while we're waiting for that to happen. So my hope is that we can make the time still count for something.
Right. And one of the things that I'm really looking forward to is announcing, and this will be after we get the first manuscript in. It won't be long before we publish, but we actually are going to be, and I'll say this, Darren Drader is working on one project for us, and Jack Norris has agreed to work on another. He hasn't started yet, but it will be something that Vigilance hasn't done yet, and that's all I'll say yet. But it's a new publishing enterprise, so that's something that we're kind of branching out, not just going forward into new markets with the same kinds of products, but we're branching out into other genres and other types of formats. So that'll be kind of exciting. But I mean, looking forward, I'm really looking at the now that we've got the field guide out there. One of the things I wanted to look for is, and you know, when Jason and I were talking about it, is where to take that setting. So, you know, what are the thing, you know, we're sort of feeling out the audience right now and finding out what, you know, and seeing how this one sells. Between you and Dan, you guys have put together a pretty good fan base for this, I have to say.
Well, that's cool.
You've got a lot of people who are really excited about this product just from, you know, it's moving pretty briskly, I'll say that.
That's good.
Nice, and I've mentioned this before, that if we get to do the villain book, if we get to do the villain book, I want to work with you, Dan, to come up with the character concepts.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Because so, rather than, like, me making up all the characters and then you drawing them and then also adding another bunch of characters of your own,
sure,
I mean, comics is about collaboration. That's what makes it fun.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, and I think what was really nice about this, the second book, the first book, I kind of laid out on the quick for PDF format only. The POD wasn't really on Chuck's or Mike's like table. They were like,
yeah.
Number one was a cost reason. Number two was Chuck had already been burned on POD,
right,
because he didn't have a quality guy like Ruben available to him for print work. Like, he had really good PDF layout guys, and then when he couldn't afford to have it done, that was another thing. Like, I laid out the first two books because there was no one else to do it at the time, and I was like, well, I'll do it, and I'll do it for nothing, so I don't care. I'd fold it into my artist like cost for this one. Again, artists, don't do that. Get paid. But if you really do believe in a project, definitely, I mean, get it out there. And luckily, you have – but the caveat is have an eye for projects, because I'll tell you this book was so well written. I was like, well, all art and layout is going to do is make this book really pop and really go well. So, but my point was, is that on the first book, I didn't write any of the names of the things that I made up as just filler art. And everyone's like, what are their names? Who are these? I'm like, they're just characters I drew.
I had totally forgotten that you did layout on the first two volumes for free. Yeah.
And it shows.
I really love the book.
But frankly, it shows. I mean, it is just Photoshop versions of PDFs. None of it was laid out in like InDesign or anything like that. I just seriously typed every page and typeset it and moved the paragraphs around physically. I didn't actually use InDesign and use all that nice word wrapping around images. I wish I knew how to do that stuff, but I don't.
But the book came out
looking okay.
Well, see, by the time that the field guide got to Chuck's desk, all those characters had been made. Some of them were years old.
Right.
But for the villains book, I haven't done that. I haven't gone through the archetypes and made all the characters yet. And so that means that you and I could just sit down and kind of throw a bunch of ideas out, make up a bunch of characters, slot them into archetypes, and then look at which ones we haven't covered. Right?
Right.
And that would be a lot of fun. Because I've only got like maybe half a dozen villains, even concepts for the for the villains book, which leaves 34 yet to do. So,
so we're going to split it into four books.
presumably.
Actually, that's an interesting question. I think I'd put that up to the audience. Is that something would the audience want us wait through books one and one through four, and wait that long, or would they rather get it all in one big helping? And I think it's something we could do it either way. There are advantages to both. And I think the biggest advantage to doing it the slow way, releasing it one book at a time, is that we have the opportunity to kind of go back and adjust things as we go forward with the previous books a little bit, not too much if we're going for print.
I'll be honest with you. I think that that's actually a double-edged sword. I mean, I love consistency in these products. And when our books never look the same from one volume to the next, it turns into, something that's it's an imperfection.
Yeah.
And if we were going to go separate volumes, I'd want to, make sure that they all kind of fit together, that they all look good together. I guess that they have a trade dress or something.
Exactly.
I had always sort of presumed that publishing it as four separate pieces was purely a device of necessity. We only did that because we had to.
Right. And this was entirely before, I took over. So it's like my approach to things, is a bit different, but one of the things that I look at is, if we do now, you would be talking about 40 archetypes.
Yeah. Same size.
So looking at about 3 to 4 pages per archetype.
Probably.
Okay. So we're talking about 160 pages.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's. I'd have to double check, but it would be really cool if we could do that as a hardcover.
Oh right, right. Well.
Wow.
I'll be honest with you, James. If you need it to be longer, a certain length to be hard.
Yeah, if you need a lot more art, trust me.
All you got to do is tell me how many pages to write, and I'll write them. I mean, I'm an academic.
I think it would be a lot of fun. And again, there's also the other option. If we do do it for Mutants and Masterminds, that changes up the layout just because the,
that's right,
the stat blocks, you know, are, yep, slightly different. Although we did come up with a good page layout for a single page stat block for icons that I think really looked good for Field Guide 4.
Right. Yeah.
That we, yep, we'd probably, you know, minimize the differences between the two layouts.
Yeah.
So if we did an icons and an M&M version of that, that would be pretty exciting. But yeah. I think it would be pretty cool to, you know, if not a hardcover, a big fat, you know, soft cover where people could, yeah, buy the one book. But I kind of prefer buying big solid books, but I know a lot of people out there like to get their stuff in smaller bite-sized chunks. So
yeah,
it's something that I'd like to hear back from. So if you're listening and you have some feedback, feel free to chime in on,
yep,
you can either comment on this blog, or on the blog post on the Vigilance Press website, or on, or email me, james@jamesdossie.com, and just let us know what you think. I'm, you know, it's still something we'd probably be shooting for next year to start working on it, but or at least after con season has kind of died down. So like right, sometime around November, you know, I would really like to know what people think. You know, would they want to see one big book, you know, the Field Guide to Supervillains, big fat, you know, 200-page book, or would you want to wait and or get it in little bite-sized chunks?
Yeah.
You know, I tend to prefer bigger books, but, you know, they're significant. They take significantly longer to assemble.
Yeah.
Simply because, you know, when you're tweaking things on one page, it affects 100 other pages. You know? So, you know, that there's, you know, if you change the layout on page 25 in such a way that it then rolls over to the next page, then you've changed the entire book. So there is some tweaking that goes on, or that's one of the reasons why a larger project takes longer to put together. It's just a matter of, you know, the dynamics of a layout. But you know, I'm just happier with a bigger book for myself, for my own. But I'm willing to buy and collect books that are pretty pricey because it's my hobby and that's what I put my money towards. But a lot of people have a lot more hobbies than I do. And they look at gaming as something of a place where they don't want to spend as much money. So I want to make it available to as many people as possible and accessible, but I'd kind of leave that up to what you guys think. But
well, yeah, it's easier for me because I write the thing regardless. So it, you guys have the hard job. I only have to write it.
Yeah.
You guys,
I mean, in the end, what we could do is just have you turn it in as one big manuscript and then,
yeah,
break, yeah, it up after that. That way,
yeah,
you know, break it into smaller chunks. But, you know, we could do the installments as PDFs and then just do the collection as a print-on-demand and just keep those as separate elements. That might be another way to do it.
So, well, these are decisions you get to make.
Yeah, but I like feedback. You know, I want to, yeah, hear what, yeah, people think. You know, what would you think? I mean, would you are you the guy who would want to wait and get it all as one book, or do you want to get the little books sooner?
Well, as a GM,
uh-huh,
the pleasure is taking the book with me to the Starbucks and reading through 160 pages of villains. I mean, that's the fun. And like figuring out, oh, and this guy I can use in next week's game, and you know, these guys are going to have to wait, or that's a cool concept, I want to totally reskin that guy, or whatever, you know. So yeah, I love the game book. I have too many game books on my shelf to dodge that bullet. Yeah.
I like a complete book.
Yeah.
I mean, when it's all there, then I don't have to buy four books,
mm-hmm,
or buy the PDF first and then get it. You know, maybe split the PDFs into four for,
yeah,
people, but the hardcover, I think having it as a complete element first, because it can be done, it seems like it would be the wisest choice.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just feels like it honors the work. I mean, I'll be honest with you. These things take an enormous amount of time to produce. They take tons of writing, tons of art, tons of layout and design. And there's a rewarding feeling to holding the thing in your hands. And you know, there's a reason why it just it feels better, and it shows the proper amount of respect towards all the hard work that everybody did. You know, I don't know. I guess it's just silly. It's an old school attitude, but it's one that I do have.
No, mm-hmm. I actually agree. I mean, you know, one of the giddy things for me this week was getting all the proofs and the bulk orders for the books that I'd published. You know, I've had one book on my shelf since like February-ish, I think it was, that we put out the Octoberman print on demand. But this week, you know, two more books on the shelf, so it's starting. I've actually got like a little, like almost an inch of shelf space. My own stuff,
right?
You know, I mean, the stuff that I've published that you guys have helped me build, and then, you know, I want to see that shelf space grow, and I'm looking forward to seeing some more print on demand stuff. I find the print stuff to be really rewarding. You know, because of the way that I get my numbers, my sales numbers back from Amazon and CreateSpace and so forth, it takes longer to find out if the audience is buying them. So, you know, I don't really know what those sales numbers are yet, mm-hmm. but, you know, I do know that the field guide has taken off like a rocket on RPG Now. People are really digging it.
Oh, that's great. Great news.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed is that, I think this is one of those happy customers are the quietest. I don't know if you noticed that, but, you know, it's kind of interesting that I've been seeing a lot of reviews for our older products popping up lately. And it's like when they were first came out and they were first reviewed, a lot of 5-star reviews. And then nowadays when somebody comes in and reviews our older products, you know, you're starting to see 3.5, 4-star reviews pop up.
Yeah.
And it's part of me thinks that they're comparing it to the newer stuff.
Oh, but, yeah. Well, that
but
would make sense.
Nobody's reviewing the newer stuff, and I'm guessing it's because they like it. So I kind of ask my audience, if you're out there listening, if you like the Zeus stuff, you know, review it. Let us know. Tell us what we're doing right as well as what we're doing wrong. So we
Troll's got a troll.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, it's a it's really rewarding though to see. I mean, clearly the sales numbers are the best reward, you know, measurement of success, and that's been a really brisk moving title. In fact, let me jump on here real quick. But I think it's at least in the top three on our. No, it's number one. Yep, Feel Good to Superheroes is currently our hottest item.
Yay!
Yep.
Hooray!
With Homefront Villains as number two, so can't argue with that. And then of course one of the interesting things is Nuclear Sunset, which came out quite a while ago. Actually, that one came out.
Isn't that Chuck's book? Didn't he do
that? That was Chuck's book, and Darren Drader is right. It just turned in the sequel to that. So. Hope, you know, people are still excited about the Nuclear Sunset series, and we will definitely have, you know, the Pacific Northwest gearing up. I'm hoping to publish that one by December, but I won't put any promises on that because we haven't even ordered the art yet, much less hit any delays.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We are still in the early part of the process. We've got the manuscript in, it's in editing, and I will start ordering art on that soon, but really excited about that because it's so different from the superhero stuff that we publish.
Yeah.
I think it's a unique opportunity to talk to some other fans, other readers. So I'm looking forward to seeing who gets invested in that. But yeah, we got so much coming up for the rest of the year. You guys may see a little bit of a bump in the PDF only stuff in the next month or two, just because I'm probably going to be focusing on that because it's a lot less complex than dealing with all of the issues that need to be dealt with for print-on-demand stuff.
Right.
But and I have the convention schedule coming up, but I'm glad that we were able to get these two products out, especially the field guide, because...
Yeah, man, I'll have that at the table!
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right, it's going to be at Gen Con!
Yep, I'm bringing a stack of them with me.
I wish I could be there. That would be a lot of fun. But Dan, you're going to have to represent.
Yep.
I will. Don't worry. In fact, I'll try and sneak a couple copies to the Adamant table as well.
Oh, yeah, right,
see,
on.
Because I'll be there 2 days.
See if Gareth will let you sell them there.
Yeah.
Well, if Gareth is listening, you know.
Yeah, Gareth, if you're listening. No promises, but come see me. You know I got the books. Or there'll be at James's table in Anime Artist Alley. James has a nice table over there. So either way, come to the con and get cool stuff.
We'll have the Anime Artist Alley table. We'll be doing some original artwork. I've got a couple of people from the podcast who will be there. Jack's going to try and make it for at least one of the days. We don't know how long he'll be able to be there. But I think Theron said he was going to be there, so hopefully he can
Theron Brett is us. Supposed to be there, yes. Because yeah. I just I know that John can't remember his last name now. Many people from the net and many Vigilance Press people should be there.
Yep.
I do know that speaking of projects, I will just give an aside. I did a children's role-playing game, RAR.
Oh,
with what? Dave Martin. Dave Martin will actually be there with a table selling RAR. So I might even swing by and sign a couple copies there too.
Cool.
But yeah.
Is he the same guy who is working on Creepy Kitchen with you?
No, that's Lee Newman. Lee Newman wrote Creepy Kitchen, and I'm doing that as well. The Kickstarter is just kickstarter.com. Just enter in Creepy Kitchen in the search bar, and you can see the actual a lot of the art, actually.
That looks like such a fun kid's book.
It has already been fun doing it. I'm already having a blast just not drawing anatomically correct things. Like, not totally, but you know what I mean? Like, I'm not drawing superheroes right now. I'm drawing things that would make little kids happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, what was it, Count Forcula?
Spatula. Count Spatula.
Yes. I love it.
The style on that is a lot like my style on RAR. He really liked that. I did another version. There's a secret, like, director's cut version of Count Spatula, who is much scarier because I illustrated it to make all of his lines. He doesn't look, like, cuddly at all. He looks very scary. And he said, that's too scary. And all I did was make a spatula that looked like Bela Lugosi. So sorry, Morphine Addicts, you're not going to get your Bela Lugosi spatula. You get a nice spatula with your fangs.
That sounds like a wonderful game, and I love the title.
Yeah, it's actually just a kid's book. It's not a game or anything. It's just illustrating. But I am open for anyone who needs kids' illustrations. I love doing it.
Yeah. We should do an alphabet book.
That would be a lot of fun.
Wouldn't
Superhero
it?
Alphabet book.
We should do an alphabet book.
A is for Atomic Rays.
Exactly, yeah.
B is for Bomb, which you can never seem to get rid of.
Be fun.
And I have a picture of Batman running around high-stepping up the bomb.
With the bat, big bomb, yeah.
With the big,
well,
you know,
James,
hissing fuse on
my
it.
My dinner is calling. Can I?
All right, yes, let's wrap it up. Okay.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for joining us on the Vigilance Press podcast. Once again, the two new books are Homefront Villains, and that is part of our Amazing Stories of World War II. And that one, I believe, forgive me if I get the numbers wrong, but I believe that one is running for $10.99, I want to say, for print on demand. And if you buy it for print on demand and the PDF at RPG Now, you save, like, I think $5 on the bundle combining the two.
It's Steve Perrin.
Buy that shit.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to swear, kids, but sometimes your children's book illustrators swear. So grow up.
And then, of course, we've got The Field Guide to Superheroes, which is the fourth and final book and the first in print on demand. And again, if you buy them both on RPG Now, I'm trying to remember. I don't think it's gone live on RPG Now for the print on demand yet.
I just realized something. Before we end, I have to ask Jason this too. The Villains book, are we going to do it for Icons first and then Mutants Masterminds, or what's the deal there?
I don't know. I mean, Icon stat blocks are so small. Maybe we could do a double stat version, or maybe we – I don't know.
Well, unfortunately, the license doesn't allow for that.
Really?
Yeah, we can't do – you know, I've asked about that, and, you know, unfortunately, the licenses – for either Mutants and Masterminds or Icons don't allow for us to do character stats for both games. But
Looks like it's going to be Icons.
Yep.
We'll have to figure out what we're going to do. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be Icons, or it could be Newton's Semester.
Oh, it has to be Icons. Sorry, Icons rules. And Mutants and Masterminds is also awesome, but Icons just slightly more so. Because
I tend to lean the other way, but I know.
I know. Crunchy granola rules, man. I need to know how many centimeters Superman punched him in the face. Well, I don't.
That would be Champions.
That's true. Okay. Hey. I don't know. You know what? I love them both. It depends on if I'm doing a really long form game, like a campaign. I choose Mutants and Masterminds every time. If I'm running a quick pickup game, it's Icons for me.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But see, thinking about it as Worlds of Wonder as a campaign, I mean, you know, that's where my head is. My head is in it as a long ongoing campaign, not a weekend pickup game. See,
well, I'm not writing the book. I'm only drawing.
You're right.
So you make those decisions, guys. Again, decisions I don't got to make are awesome decisions.
This is where the people who buy the book and who read the book should speak up, because
drop some comments down.
You are the audience. You are the audience, and we have to write to the audience.
Yep.
Yes, indeed. So drop some knowledge in the field guide to superheroes. Drop some comments.
Is there anything else you guys wanted to plug before you jump off into the ether?
Oh, no, I'm good. Thank you.
Yes,
it's a pleasure to be here.
I want to plug something that I'm not going to talk about, but I will say this. Stay tuned, everybody. Anytime you hear me on a podcast just before Gen Con, there'll be a gigantic announcement. Plus, at Gen Con, if you see me there, you will know what my announcement is about.
Cool.
So,
cool.
Now I'm excited.
Announcement that's coming out soon.
All right. Excellent.
All right.
Super. Okay, guys. Thanks again for joining me. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And as always, until next time, stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.